And on the 557th day, the trade war rested. Kinda. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the 14th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We have tried, lordy, have we tried to keep you up to speed on the great Sino-American trade war of 2018-19 without overwhelming you, because really, the appetite for a whole lot of this.
Harmonized Tariff Schedule 5608.19.20. Knotted netting of twine, cordage or rope, excluding fish netting or made-up fishing nets, of man-made textile materials.
Or this.
Harmonized Tariff Schedule 4105.10.10. Sheep or lambskins, without wool on, tanned but not further prepared. Wet blue.
Wet blue, what even is that? Anyway, your appetite for that is probably finite. But look, this trade war is the most important thing that's happened in the global economy in the past 2 years. It has rattled global markets. It has changed the decisions the Federal Reserve has made. It has bewildered small businesses, and it has cost American consumers and businesses billions of dollars. So today on the program, with the deal set to be signed tomorrow, how we got here, where here really is, and where do we go from here?
Today, I'm directing the United States Trade Representative to examine China's policies, practices, and actions with regard to the forced transfers of American technology and the theft of American intellectual property.
We will spare you the whole timeline. We've got it online, marketplace.org, if you want the nuts and bolts. But that right there, from President Trump back in August of 2017, that is the trade war origin story. From there, it was just a short step to global tariffs on washing machines and solar panels, steel and aluminum. And as things stand now, tariffs of as much as 25% on more than half of everything that we buy from China. It's important to point out two more things, really. Number one, we don't actually know what's in the deal that's supposed to be signed tomorrow, and we won't until after it's signed. And number two, a deal it may be, but this is not the end of the trade war. We are still putting tariffs on $370 billion worth of Chinese imports. And in a statement to Bloomberg today, Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer said, and this is a quote, "There is no agreement for future reductions in tariffs." So where it's all gotten us and where it might lead us straight ahead. On Wall Street this day before deal day, not a whole lot of trade-inspired enthusiasm. See also priced in. So from us, some trade war details when we do the numbers. If you're running a business in this economy, big or small, and out of the relative blue comes news you're going to have to pay as much as 25% more for the materials you need to make the goods that you sell, that is going to concentrate your mind. And you're going to start thinking about how to change the way you do business. So we got back on the phone the past couple of days with some of the people we have been talking to throughout this trade war to ask them what's changed in the way they do business.
We've certainly seen projects that have either been put off till later or full out canceled.
We have raised some prices where possible. We did move some production to other countries. There are some small numbers of products that we're simply not offering.
It's actually caused most companies to freeze because they don't know if that's going to be the same policy a month or a year or 4 years down the road.
We've hired over 150 people. So yes, it's made an enormous positive difference. There's no doubt about that.
That was Kelly Speaks Backman. She's the CEO of the Energy Storage Association. Peter Bragdon is the executive vice president at Columbia Sportswear. Nicole Vassalaros is a senior vice president in the National Marine Manufacturers Association. And Michael Korchmar at the end there, he's the CEO of the Korchmar Leather Specialty Company. More from them and a couple others later on. The deal that is set to be signed tomorrow, 11:30 Washington time, by the way, is the easy stuff. The Chinese are, we are told, going to buy more American exports, agriculture mostly. The Trump administration has put off or rolled back some of its tariffs. That's what we know here. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack is in Shanghai trying to figure out what Chinese consumers know.
It's never been easy to get Chinese people on Shanghai streets to speak to the foreign media. But now with the U.S.-China trade dispute, even talking economics can get people in trouble with the authorities. So when we ask a man to comment on the trade talks, he tries to speed past us. I don't have time to talk, he says. The woman he is with tells me she doesn't follow the trade talks. She's not the only one. China's state-run media hasn't covered the trade talks much. What is reported on Chinese TV is that China and the U.S. have agreed on areas like intellectual property, technology transfer, and financial services, without listing specifics. The deal is a success. At least that's what Fan Chengxin, a retiree, heard.
As long as China doesn't get the short end of the stick, then any trade deal is okay.
What few details people know about the Phase 1 trade deal comes from the U.S. media. The Trump administration says it will not increase tariffs and even cut a portion of the duties by half on $120 billion worth of Chinese goods. And that's a major turning point, says international trade expert Tu Xinquan.
Because President Donald Trump really likes to add tariffs. So the fact that he's cutting back on some tariffs is an important factor to stabilize U.S.-China trade relations.
American officials have said China has committed to buy at least $40 billion worth of U.S. agricultural goods annually for the next two. That's nearly double the amount the Chinese bought from the U.S. in 2017, before the trade tensions. Kent Kettle in Shanghai is with the consultancy group Control Risk.
Can China really buy that much? They've never bought, you know, that much agricultural products in the past. Are they going to be able to?
Others are looking for regulatory changes. Matthew Margulies is with the U.S.-China Business Council.
For agriculture companies, it is, you know, getting products approved in the market faster. It's getting better intellectual property rights protections. A lot of the stuff that was raised in the Section 301 agreement.
Section 301 is the rule dealing with unfair barriers to U.S. trade. And it's the Trump administration's justification for retaliating against China and leveling the playing field. But Zhang Ronglong, a security guard, doesn't buy that argument, especially after the U.S. put Chinese tech giant Huawei on its trade blacklist.
The U.S. is bullying China. Trump started with Huawei and has been trying to break the Chinese economy to maintain American hegemony.
He says China can survive without the U.S. And that kind of talk scares some analysts who still see many U.S. firms wanting to enter China. Again, Kent Kettle.
So much trust has been destroyed over the past 2 years. I'm very, very pessimistic about a phase two deal.
If the trade tensions drag on, some people say China should remain tough on the U.S.
If only the Chinese can all boycott American products, the impact of the trade war on China will be limited.
He tells me his surname Sun, but before I could get his full name, his colleague interrupts us. Stop recording, she says. She's just heard we are an American media outlet and pulls Mr. Sun away. Even expressing support for China is seen as dangerous. From the streets of Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Trade policy can be dense. We get that. Confusing sometimes, too. And it doesn't help that there's a lot of disinformation about the trade war being floated by President Trump and his advisors, which is real frustrating for people running businesses in this economy.
It's a total myth that it's China that's paying and bearing the cost of this. It's really the U.S. companies, the U.S. importers who pay the tariffs who are bearing the cost.
That the tariff is being paid by China or some other country. I mean, imposing tariffs is, you know, it's essentially like taking economic poison and counting on it hurting somebody else.
That China's paying these taxes.
That was Julie Hughes. She's the president of the U.S. Fashion Industry Association. Peter Bragdon at Columbia Sportswear again. Also, Nicole Vassilaris with the National Marine Manufacturers Association. Two quick things on this. Number one, academic study after academic study the past year and a half has shown American businesses and consumers are paying all of the extra costs of the tariffs. Number two, how much are those costs? A study from the New York Fed last year figured it to be about $831 a year for the typical American household. Congresswoman Jackie Walorski, Republican of Indiana, represents a key slice of the American manufacturing economy, RVs, mostly in Elkhart, Indiana, and surroundings. So she has been especially aware of and vocal about the trade war and its effects, including on this program a couple of times in the past couple of years. So we got her back on the phone ahead of the signing tomorrow. Congresswoman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much.
So we had you on, a year and a half or so ago when this whole thing started, and you were... You were not happy, I think is fair. As we sit here on the eve of a trade one deal and with USMCA making its way through the Congress, how you feeling?
Well, I think getting USMCA done is a huge victory for all of us, for the American farmer, for manufacturers, and, you know, just my district alone, because we lead in exports and we manufacture all kinds of things. You know, this is, it's good. It's good for America's, it's good for my district, and I am very, very pleased that this thing has moved through.
So you took the easy part of that answer because I gave you the opening, but let me get you to China specifically. We're here on the eve of a deal that we don't know what's in it. You were vociferously opposed to the way it was handled by the Trump administration and by Secretary Ross. Are you satisfied that it's going to do well for your district, one of the biggest manufacturing districts in this country?
Well, here's the thing. So, and I still am in the position that China's gotten away with unfair trade practices for so long. I will tell you this phase one agreement will make progress toward ending China's most egregious abuses, but it also provides some tariff relief. So this is welcome news for us, for, you know, my district, for farmers and for manufacturers. But I'm going to be very, very involved again with oversight in making sure at every step of the way that this actually works and that we are bringing the kind of relief that we're talking about and that we're holding China responsible. But I do think we're in the best possible position having gone through the USMCA process.
Do you know what's in it, the China deal? Have you seen the language?
You know, highlights, we know what highlights are, but as we found out with the USMCA, the devil's in the details. So I'll be 100% engaged in oversight and making sure that these details are understood ahead of time and that we're involved, paving the way, making this fair, again, for American companies and for agriculture especially.
What's changed for American companies in your district? As I said, extremely heavily a manufacturing district. This has reconfigured a whole lot of supply chains and a whole lot of the way business works in manufacturing in this country. What's changed for your constituents?
Well, I'll tell you what. So, you know, we have been at the switch, making sure that this is fair, that the exclusion processes are fair. And obviously, we also went to the mat for the RV industry, the recreational vehicle industry that basically is headquartered in our district with thousands and thousands of workers. What we've learned through USMCA, the exclusion processes and those kinds of things has helped us better message and be very, very effective at being able to ask for different kinds of concessions from Secretary Ross. And so we also, as in my office, are in a stronger position to deal with this as well.
How can you be confident in enforcement and that things are going to turn out the way you want them when we don't want to know what's in it other than to have the president and Ambassador Lighthizer say, yes, we're going to have enforcement capabilities?
Well, I'll tell you again, USMCA was a great example of how do you get to enforcement? Well, you know what? You, as members of Congress, insist on it. You know, our job is to continue to press where we can press for accountability and transparency, but also to press and to stand in the gap there with Secretary Ross and demand, things to be right, fair, and, you know, equally treatment with what we see rolling out in this Chinese agreement.
Congresswoman Jackie Walorski, Republican of Indiana. Ma'am, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Coming up,
I think time will tell
where we go from here in trade policy. First, though, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. The Dow Industrials today gained 32 points, a 10th percent, 28,009. The Nasdaq down 22 points, about a quarter percent, 92 and 51. The S&P 500 dropped 5 points, a 10th percent, 32 and 83. So back on the day when the White House announced the first round of tariffs in this trade war, Friday, June the 15th, 2018, here's what was going on. Boeing down as much as 2.5% at one point. Caterpillar gave up a little bit more than 3% at its low. Apple and Intel down as well. Companies with big China exposure, right? Companies that don't have a lot of exposure in China, Netflix and Costco, they did pretty well that day. So here we are, a year and a half later. How'd things go? Boeing finished up 0.6%. Of course, trade is not the only thing weighing on its share price. Caterpillar down about 0.1%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.81%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There is some non-trade business and economic news on this Tuesday. Bank earnings started coming out this morning. They are mostly doing really well. Boeing is not. Last year, we learned today, was its worst for new jet orders and deliveries in a decade and a half. And BlackRock, the world's biggest money management firm, has drawn a line in the climate change sand, putting climate change and sustainability at the heart of its investment decisions. In his annual letter today, BlackRock CEO Larry Fink said the risks of climate change will lead to, and this is a quote, a fundamental reshaping of finance. So what do you suppose that looks like? Here's Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino.
Today, BlackRock is making waves as an advocate for the environment, but just last October, protesters were dumping ashes in front of the firm's London offices to draw attention to how its investments contribute to climate change, as heard in this video report from The Guardian. As a firm overseeing $7 trillion in assets, BlackRock can start moving the needle on climate change, says Moira Burse with the nonprofit Amazon Watch.
BlackRock helps clients every day make decisions about where they're putting their money. And so it has immense power to shift how funds are being invested around the world.
BlackRock's move signals the growing acknowledgement that sustainability is good business, says UC Berkeley environmental law professor Ethan Elkind.
The financial sector has been paying more attention to climate change because it really threatens their investments.
BlackRock says it will pull back from investments in industries such as coal in its actively managed portfolios and use its influence as a large shareholder to move against company management teams that aren't making enough progress on sustainability.
The companies really hear the voice of investors. They really respond.
Kirsten Spalding is with the nonprofit Ceres, which advocates for sustainable investments.
We think that it really is going to impact the global system.
By putting pressure on other large investors to follow suit. And it's a notable change for BlackRock itself. Ceres previously ranked the firm toward the bottom of the pack of asset managers based on their lackluster history of backing climate-related proposals from shareholders. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Real quick here before I forget, the news is about to start getting busy. Busier, I guess. So if for some reason you miss us on the air, we've got a podcast that is available pretty much everywhere. We've been hearing from businesses today and how they've adjusted to the trade war. Congresswoman Walarski as well, Jennifer Pack in Shanghai. Now somebody whose trade concerns are similar but whose responsibilities are different. Robert Kaplan is the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, Texas. Mr. Kaplan, good to talk to you again, sir.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
So here we sit conceivably at the beginning of the end of the trade war. One never knows exactly what's going to happen. How you feeling?
Well, I don't think it's the beginning of the end of the trade war. I think it is a beginning of some stabilization, we hope. I think the trade dispute with China is going to go on for years, but I do think that the implementation of this phase one deal is dramatically better than the alternative, which would have been escalation. And I think that could have well been damaging to global growth and the U.S. economy.
To the specific point of why we wanted to get you on the phone, Chair Powell has talked about it many times. You and I have spoken about it. What trade and the trade uncertainty has done to this economy the past 18 months. I'm curious as to how it has changed the thinking in that big conference room in the building on Constitution Avenue when y'all get together and talk about things.
Well, it's impacted our thinking in that we're dealing with three specific challenges right now. Global growth is very sluggish, and in fact, probably more sluggish than it's been since 2009. Manufacturing related to that in the United States is weaker than it's been since 2009. And business fixed investment is sluggish. It's been offset by the fact we've had a strong consumer. Mm. We think all of those three weaknesses are related very heavily to trade and trade uncertainty.
This is a little sideways, but do you all actually get on planes and go to Washington, or do you do a conference call?
We are in person. Huh. We sit in a room, we shut the door, no devices in the room, and meetings are all in person, nobody calls in.
Interesting. Okay, back to the substance. As you start thinking then now about this new era of increased stability, I suppose, how much, on the assumption that it's factored in a whole lot in the past 18 months to monetary policy, how much do you figure it's going to weigh on it now?
Well, I don't think trade uncertainty has gone away. And when I talk to businesses, they are still concerned about trade uncertainty. But I think they're hopeful for a little bit more stability, a little bit more predictability, which will lead to better economic outcomes here.
Let me ask the guy sitting in Dallas, what's weighing more on you, the USMCA or China?
For Texas, and I actually think for the United States, shoring up our trade arrangements in North America was essential. The trade tensions with China last year were challenging, but the threat a few months ago against Mexico because of the border situation, the threat of escalated tariffs, that really had a substantial effect on the outlook of businesses. The fact that we've got stabilization now in that relationship, we think will help the U.S. be more globally competitive and we believe take share from Asia in the future.
Oh, that's interesting. You actually think that's going to happen, taking share from Asia?
We think that's what was happening before the trade dispute started with Mexico. We think U.S. companies were becoming more globally competitive. The trade relationship with Mexico was key to that. And our belief was we were taking share from Asia, and so we would hope that would resume and continue.
All right, so here comes the pokey in the eye question. Do you think China and USMCA and the talk of European car tariffs and all of that jazz, has the last 18 months in global trade been worth it? Have we gotten where we wanted to be?
I think time will tell.
Time will tell.
Listen, let's put it differently. We think USMCA was a modernization from NAFTA, not a material change, but a modernization. I think we're not necessarily seeing the benefits yet, but I think to have a dispute over technology transfer, intellectual property rights with China, who we're going to be competing with for the next number of decades. It's understandable why the U.S. wanted to have an ability to address those issues.
Rob Kaplan is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, also as of this year, once again, a voting member of the Federal Open Market Committee. Mr. Kaplan, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai. Good to talk to you.
With a nod to what Mr. Kaplan at the Dallas Fed just said, that trade policy stability is going to be key from now on, some of the business people we've been talking to say that's a bit too little too late.
There continues to be just far too much uncertainty, and that's been the case for the last couple of years.
Our industry has undergone quite some uncertainty whether or not these tariffs will be impacting their jobs and their business and their deployments for the long term.
It is indeed a frustration that we don't know what's in it and the text won't be released until after the signing on Wednesday. And we don't know when the tariff will be reduced, which just makes it even more chaotic and unpredictable for companies than you need it to be.
Sometimes we can engineer our products differently, but you can't engineer around chaos.
That was Peter Bragdon at Columbia Sportswear one last time at the start and at the end of that. Kelly Spees-Backman of the Energy Storage Association. Also, Julie Hughes with the U.S. Fashion Industry Association. Final note on the way out today, an item from Bloomberg that neatly sums up some of what we have been talking about today. Trade, our relationship with Mexico, Boeing and its problems. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has been trying to sell his government's presidential plane, a Boeing 787 Dreamliner. AMLO, as he's known, has been shopping the plane for a year to no avail, $130 million, by the way. López Obrador said this week he has even tried to give it to President Trump in a barter deal. We'll give them the plane, he said. They can pay us in kind. Apparently didn't even get a call back. Okay, we're done on this day before deal day. The Dow Industrial is up 32 points, about a 10%. The NASDAQ down 22 points, about a 0.25% there. The S&P 500 off 5 points, a 0.1%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.